I just want to welcome you all. Thank you all for being here. It's quite a special night. I love ceremony, and I love when ceremonies are special with us and we're used to them. So we know that it's special when we come. And tonight, for those of you that are new to Seattle Inside, we are going to do the Refuges and Precepts. Every first sit of the year, we do the Refuges and Precepts and renew our kind of commitment both to the Dhamma and to Seattle Inside in a way. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. Very nice. And Tim and I do it together. And so it's always special when we're together. I love teaching with Tim. So that makes it even more special. I don't know how many, I can't see how many of you might be new, but if you're new to Seattle Insight, thank you so much for being here. This is an annual thing. We have, this is not the only sit that we offer. We do offer a sit on Sunday mornings, which can be, that's a little different. And we offer a sit on Thursday evenings, and that's different. And we offer a drop-in sits throughout the week. And those are all different. So the thing that I really love about what Seattle Insight is turning into is the capacity to meet people where they are. And that you're not left with just one sit, that you either have to be in a space to do that sit or you miss it. So it's very open. You can check our website out. We have lots of things that we offer throughout the year, just to try to keep us all urban practitioners connected to our sit. Tonight, we're going to be a little different. Usually, we don't do the Refuges and Precepts ceremony until the end of the evening. But tonight, we're going to do it a little differently. We're going to have a sit for about a half hour, and then we're going to, Tim and I are going to take a little time to talk about the refuges. He's going to talk about the refuges, I'll talk about the precepts. And then we're going to do the ceremony to have it connected to what it is that we're talking about the way it would normally be. And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about Donna and volunteering and things like that, how to keep our Sangha together and growing, even though everything is quite different, sort of putting the refuges and precepts into actual action. And if we have time, we want to ask, take some questions or comments or whatever you have, and then we'll kind of close out the evening. Oh, we're going to talk a little bit, Tim is going to talk a little bit about, or maybe we both will, about what the teaching theme is going to be for this year. You know, every year we do a different theme, and so we're going to talk a little bit about what the theme's going to be for this year. I think that's it. Did I miss anything, Tim? Oh, did I say that we weren't going to take a break? Because that's usually we take a break after the sit, but we're not really going to do that. We trust that you can all take a break if you need to. Otherwise, we'll try to keep it going so it doesn't really lag a lot. And just kind of enjoy the evening together. All right? So we're going to start with a sit, silent sit, for a half hour. So, or actually, it's going to be 25 minutes because it's going to end at 7:30. But I want to give you the poem to contemplate. If you got to think about something, you can contemplate on this and not let your mind wander around bills and drama and stuff going on in your life, in the world, all the other things the mind wants to think about other than the breath. So this is by a person named Ian McCrory. He has a book called The Moon Appears When the Water is Still. I love this book. It's a lot of Zen reflections. It's really his, some Dhamma reflections or his thoughts on some Zen stories. But this is what one of his reflections is. We must start from where we are, not from where we want to be. For where we want to be is to be content with where we are. We may be in hell, but if we are patient and allow hell to be hellish, then this balance of mind, this quiet contentment, changes hell into heaven. The 1/16th of an inch difference between heaven and hell is equanimity. So consider, as we're sitting here, are you trying to get to some state of calm and tranquility, some peaceful state? Mind is thinking. Can you just let it do what it does and think? That's okay. Do you even know what state of mind you're in? Do you know if you're irritated? Do you know if you're frustrated? Do you know if you're peaceful? And see if we can just contemplate being with whatever is arising throughout our sit. All right, so let's try that. I'll ring the bell to get us started. We must start from where we are, not from where we want to be. For where we want to be is to be content with where we are. We may be in hell, but if we are patient and allow hell to just be hellish, then this balance of mind, this quiet contentment, changes hell into heaven. The 1/16th of an inch difference between heaven and hell is equanimity.
All right. Thank you, Tuari, for that lovely poem and the meditation. It's always a joy to teach with you. And thanks for sharing this evening. This is wonderful to see so many familiar faces and for people I haven't seen for a long time. So welcome all. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the co-guiding teachers along with Tuari here at Seattle Insight. And tonight I'd like to speak a little bit about the refuges. These three refuges. And to start with reading a brief section from the Dhammapada called the Supreme Refuge, or Refuge Supreme. They go to many a refuge, to mountains and forest, to park and tree shrines, people threatened with danger. That's not the secure refuge, not the supreme refuge. That's not the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. But when, having gone to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha for refuge, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the transcending of suffering, and the Eightfold Noble Path, the way to the stilling of suffering. That is the secure refuge, that the supreme refuge, that is the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. A refuge supreme from the Dhammapada. So this idea of refuge and where is a true refuge, you know, so often we seek it in areas which aren't a true release from our suffering, a true release from our, you know, this underlying cause of dukkha. And these three refuges of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, of the Sangha, are this foundation of us as Buddhists. It's one of the defining factors. If we really take that in, that becomes part of being what's called Buddhist. Of course, you know, you don't have to take that on as an identity. It can be more of a path or a way of practice. Now, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, the person who discovered this way through dukkha to understand how dukkha arose, how it's ceased, and the path to it, and his profound teachings that he was able to uncover, to discover some 2,600 years ago. And the Dhamma, this path that he laid out, this series and body, vast body of teachings, of roadmaps to awakening, to enlightenment, and also a deep understanding of how things actually are, a deep piercing understanding of the nature of life, the nature of our own minds, the nature of our hearts. And then the Sangha, the community, the people who walk that path, who practice together. You know, looking at all these faces, you know, over 100 people, and how we form this. The Sangha comes together, all united under this path. So it's reflecting on the refuges and also reflecting on SIMS and what really SIMS's purpose is. You know, why does it exist as an organization? You know, it's been around almost a quarter of a century or longer. And how does this relate to these refuges? I would sum up, you know, from my own perspective, that the main purpose of SIMS is to help people engage in the Dharma, to help people find that spark that allows their hearts to open, their hearts to start to ease, to let go of some of that contraction of mind and of heart, to understand the nature of their suffering, to understand the release of that suffering, to engage with it, to feel that sense of understanding in a very deep way, going into our cells, into our bones. And also, the purpose of SIMS is to create a community around this path of like-minded people to support each other and engaging in the Dharma. So how do the refuges relate to this purpose of SIMS as an organization, as a community? Now we can look at the refuges as this triple gem, you know, these three elements that really interrelate and interwork together. They have a sense of mutual support, mutual enhancement of each other. We can almost take any one of the three refuges and see how the other two support it in a profound way, and vice versa. So in this little exploration tonight, I'd like to bring forth the Dharma, or the Dhamma, as this central point to the foreground, to see how both the Buddha and the teachers that have grown from the Buddha, and also the Sangha, profoundly support this element of the Dharma, of engaging in it. So what does it mean to engage in the Dharma? And I think this is the key question. Because we can read about the Dharma, it can sound like a nice philosophy, but there's some point when it starts to transform the very way we are in the world. We start to find ourselves acting in a different way than we have ever thought even possible. You know, not in some kind of supernatural way, but simply coming from a place of kindness, a sense of consideration, a sense of presence, a sense of groundedness, and a sense of clarity of mind. We start to be able to relate to our own mind, our own struggles, our own contractions, in a way that somehow seemed completely inaccessible before we started to practice. Certainly our meditation practice is a profound aspect of this, is a place to really nurture that deeper seeing, the clarity of seeing, the depth of seeing. And taking what we learn in our practice into our daily lives. Tweri and I have spent this last year exploring Dharma in daily life, and it was very interesting to see these different lenses that we would bring into the Dharma and see how does it show up in relationships? How does it show up in ritual? How does it show up in all these different elements of our lives? Because that's when the Dharma starts to really engage in it. when we start to find ourselves living from it and acting from that place. It starts to transform everything that we touch, everything that we do, every relationship that we have, of those we hold dear to us, the ones we cherish, the ones we have difficulty with, the ones that we are indifferent to. Each one of these relationships start to be transformed by our growing understanding. So the central purpose of SIMS to really help us as human beings to engage in the Dharma, to engage in how it really shows up for us in a very personal way and also impersonal. We start to see this beautiful juxtaposition of these two elements back and forth. And then looking at that as a central piece, how does Sangha and how does the Buddha come to support that? So the Buddha, I'm going to expand to the Buddha's students and people who start to teach from his guidance and how that is passed down over the centuries, you know, down to Tueri and myself and other teachers who have gone through, you know, been walked into this lineage. And, you know, certainly we're not of the Buddha, but we are representing him. We bring that quality of the lineage in. And how does that relate to this relationship of understanding the Dharma and engaging the Dharma? Especially as guiding teachers, you know, Tueri and I often talk about this, is how do we hold the essence of our understanding of the Dharma, you know, close to every action that we bring? How do we help the organization stay true to the Dharma in its most pure way, its deepest way? And so we, as teachers, are helping to point the way. You know, we offer talks, we offer meditations, we offer guidance. And it's really helping, the purpose of that is to help people engage in their Dharma for themselves. Because only you can engage in it. Only you can allow your heart to take to light with the joy of the Dharma, with the insight of that. Only you can walk that path. We're almost, at the best, we're just accurate guidepost. You know, we point the way in a clear way. And we also act as course corrections. We may say, okay, you're going the wrong direction here. Let's make a little course direction to help us see our ignorance, to see what's not clearly seen, that level of delusion. And so this is how we support as teachers, is to keep us as really true to the essence of what the Buddha taught and how that is an alive understanding, alive truth in this day and age, in this modern society with all its unique difficulties, in these modern lives with all the diversity of struggle, of difficulty. How can we bring the teachings alive in these times? And then the third gem, the third refuge, is the Sangha, of these like-minded people coming together to meet, to talk, to explore. I think we all know when we come into a meditation hall in the physical form, it can feel, it's palpable how the very environment has been transformed by people sitting. And if you come to late to a sit, you can feel the stillness, you can feel that quality of presence, as everyone is really united and simply meeting this moment just how it's arising. And as you go and talk to your fellow practitioners, talk about your insights, talk about your struggles and how they listen to you, they take you in, they hear you in a way that is not, you don't have to explain yourself. They get something about you in a profound way. This is this common path, walking the same path, this like-mindedness. And engagement in the Sangha, in practicing, in coming to events, in listening and speaking and sharing, offering of your own help, your own service, helping with volunteering, helping with small tasks or big tasks. These are all part of how the sense of Sangha supports this engagement in the Dharma, engagement in letting that come alive in each one of our hearts. So these triple gem of the three refuges of the Buddha, of the Dharma, out of the Sangha. This is really the essence of us as practitioners. And so at times when things are going in difficult ways, and you feel like, okay, where can I find a sense of refuge? Where can I find a place of release from this struggle that I'm having? To reflect, you know, what's my normal way of doing it? My normal way that's perhaps embedded in the very way that I create suffering for myself. And then remembering this triple gem, the three refuges, and see if you can call that forth in the midst of that difficulty. And once you start to get a confidence of that, then that refuge becomes more and more your habit, becomes more and more your default. And then going even beyond the difficulty of life, you start to see the joy of life is also supported in a profound way by these three refuges. It allows you to open your eyes to truly see, to truly experience how life is in this moment, to truly meet this other person in all their, as the poem that Tuari shared, you know, meeting people how they actually are, meeting ourselves how they actually are, both in our joys and our sorrows. So I look forward to taking the refuges with you later tonight, and thank you for your being here as part of our community of Sims.
And thank you, Tim. I'm going to talk about the other side. I'm so glad that we put the refuges and the precepts together when we say them. Because I always think of the refuges, like Tim was pointing to, as being personal, and you know, how we personally are able to connect to the Dhamma, and then the precepts is how we can connect to the Dhamma in community. What happens? I found a quote by Thich Nhat Hanh. For those of you that don't know Thich Nhat Hanh, who's also called Thay, he's a Zen, Vietnamese Zen practitioner monk, and he was a monk in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And he coined a phrase, engaged Buddhism, even though we all kind of use it all the time. I want to tell you what he said as to why that phrase came into existence. He said, we coined the term engaged Buddhism in the 1960s when the war was very intense in Vietnam. We practiced sitting meditation and walking meditation, but we could hear the bombs falling outside and the cries of the wounded. To meditate is to be aware of what's going on, and what's going on at that time was suffering, and what was going on at that time was suffering and the destruction of life. That sounds a little familiar here. Okay, so just keep it going a little bit. He says, once you know what's going on, you're motivated by a desire to do something to relieve the suffering, both in you and around you. And so we had to find a way to practice mindful breathing and do walking meditation while helping those wounded by bombs. Because if you don't maintain a spiritual practice during the time you serve, you will lose yourself and you will burn out. And so we learn to breathe, to walk, to release the tension so we could keep going. These are the origins of engaged Buddhism. It was born in a difficult situation where we wanted to maintain our practice while responding to suffering. In such a situation, anything you do in mindfulness, whether it is social action, drinking your tea, sitting in meditation, or making breakings, you do it not only for yourself, you are preserving yourself so you can help the world. I just, you know, that is what we're living in. That is the truth of it. We are living in difficult times. We are not living to get rid of the difficult times, because I don't really see how this is going to get much easier. I got a feeling, I don't know, not prophetic, but I got a feeling it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And in order for us to be able to be in the world like this, we're going to have to practice. We have to be, take our refuges and then learn to practice with the precepts. Because what the precepts point to is fundamentally doing no harm. We don't do any harm to property, our property and the property of another. We don't do any harm to bodies, our body, the bodies of others. We don't do any harm to words and language, the way we talk to each other, the way we talk to ourselves. And we don't do any harm with the things of this life. You know, the things that we use as lay practitioners to move through life, the things we consume, the food we eat, the things we drink, the television we watch, the social media we use these things in life, but we don't do harm in relationship to it. So as practitioners, we are building our lives around fundamentally not doing any harm to each other or to ourselves. That's what these precepts are. And they're simple because we undertake the training for them. They are not edicts that says, I will not cause harm. I wish we could say that. I wish I could say that. I've already caused harm and I've been home from retreat for a week and I've already done a mess. I got my son saying, you sure you don't want to go back and finish up a couple more days to help smooth out the rough edges? So I went on my personal retreat, and then when I came back, I was so sensitive, I'm snapping at everything. It's not that we intend to do harm. The truth is we do harm. So the precepts are a training to undertake so that when I become aware of the harm and when I start getting sensitive enough to see that harm, I can actually stop myself. I can actually begin to let go of that. You know, we live in a time when the precepts are really called sila. And we live in a time where everybody wants to learn mindfulness and practice meditation so they can get peaceful and calm. Because the notion is, if you're in a world as difficult as we are in, if I could just be calm, not so reactive, if I could just be more peaceful, then I can live in a world like this. I got to tell you, chances are you're going to get pretty reactive, pretty unpeaceful, uncalm. And the need for sila in relation to meditation becomes important. They are essentially tied together. The meditation helps us get more and more and more sensitive. It's kind of counterintuitive to get more and more and more sensitive in a world where there's so much difficulty. But that is what Thich Nhat Hanh, or I like to call him Tay, that's what he was pointing to. No, we want to get more sensitive. Because when we begin to get more sensitive, we actually feel harm. When we harden ourselves against that sensitivity, we don't know the harm. We're still causing it. We just don't know that we're causing it. So we're walking around like Mr. Magoo, if any of you guys remember him. Some of you might be a little young for Mr. Magoo, but some of you know who I'm talking about. he would walk around and just cause destruction in his path, but he never realized how badly he was causing so much destruction. And in some respects, as humans, we cause so much harm. Individually, all of us, not any one group has a throne or scepter on causing harm. We all do it. But if you begin to get sensitive to the nature of harm, you begin to feel when you are causing harm. You begin to hear someone tell you, like my son telling me, you need to settle down some here. He started telling me that. I could hear it. Like, oh my God, what? Let me settle down a little bit. I can hear it, not with defensiveness of I'm fine, or all the mess that's going on, you know, all the stuff that's going on, that's what's causing all the harm. It's not that. It's just me causing harm. Settle down some. I can do that because I can feel it. I can sense it. And that is a level of sensitivity. I can sense his harm. I can sense his pain. I can sense other people's pain. And that sensitivity is not harming us. That sensitivity is what's actually helping us see. So then a couple of things that Tim said, if we take this meditation and we click it into this sila, these precepts, we're practicing meditation and this kind of mindfulness, and we're seeing more and more harm, getting more and more sensitive. You can tell that our inclination would be to blame ourselves, beat ourselves up. I could beat myself up just for how I've been the last week. It's not necessary. That is the wisdom of Dhamma, that you can begin to see, cut through the delusion that you can control everything and that everything is your responsibility. And you can begin to settle into just the acknowledgement of the harm is sufficient. Just the acknowledgement of the pain is sufficient. And set these intentions to do no harm. And start again. Begin again. It's the wisdom. It's the wisdom. I like that Tim pointed out that transformative nature of Dhamma. The wisdom that comes from that, when you're practicing in the sila, that is how it is that we move through this world in very, very difficult times, doing the least amount of harm possible. We kind of learn in our sangha as community how to engage in that transformative effect of that Dhamma. And as we practice together, we kind of learn the wisdom of anatta, this non-self, the wisdom of anicca, the constant changing of things, the realization that I can't control everything, and the inevitability of dukkha. And when we start seeing that, we are less fighting what is as it is, and we are coming into an understanding of how to be with and be a almost like a shining light, a beacon in difficult times. I don't know how many of you are history fanatics, but I am. But if you know anything about history, what gives us encouragement is to read the inspirational stories of people who lived through difficult times, and even if they didn't do hardly nothing, they just lived through difficult times and they were an inspiration. That is sufficient. They were some kind of a light out there in the darkness. And I was telling someone, I can't remember who I was saying, but I don't believe that as practitioners, we can continuously practice week after week after week, come together, meditate, talk about the Dhamma, and share in this practice week after week after week after week, year after year after year after year, and we are not going to have a profound impact on the nature of the world. I just do not believe that's possible. I have been in too many retreats, and the transformative effects of Dhamma is so palpable in the room. Of course, when you're on retreat, you're in a confined space, so that transformative tranquility, that energetic feel that you feel when you're at a retreat, it's confined into a smaller space. And we're working with vast areas of land, so it's going to take a lot more time to kind of build up that level of transformative energy that transforms the world. It takes a lot longer because it can disseminate out into the space much easier. It's not contained in four walls. But all the sanghas all over this country, all the sanghas all over the world, all meditating, all renewing their vows, all coming together in this transformative way with Dhamma. Yeah, I just believe we will have a huge impact. At some point, we will begin to see the effects of that practice. And so that's what we do. We practice, we be a light unto ourselves and a beacon into the darkness so that all beings can be liberated. And all beings can know and feel the liberation from the release of suffering. I saw a post. You guys may have seen it. It was posted recently. I saw it before, but it was recently posted again, of His Holiness crying when he was giving a talk. And I think he begin to think about the level of suffering that was in the world. I saw a fuller version of it once before, but he was talking about the suffering in the world and something triggered him and he began to cry. And I mean, he didn't cry like, okay, just a minute, just a minute. It wasn't like that. It was full on. And he was crying and I was just like overwhelmed. Like, no, you can't cry. I can cry, but you can't cry. And he was crying so hard. And he let himself cry like that. He let himself. He didn't try to suck it up, keep himself together. He let himself cry. And he just cried until he was done. And he wiped his eyes and he continued. But in the clip, it's just him crying. But this is some of what we have to let ourselves do. Feel the harm, practice with this harm, and then maintain our sila and undertake these vows to refrain from adding more harm into the world, either to property, to bodies, in our speech, and in the things we consume in life. So thank you so much for being here, your time, your practice, the sincerity of it, and for, you know, supporting each other the way we do. So we are going to do the precepts now because you see how it is closely connected to what we're saying. So this is when we want to really do the precepts and not wait until the end of the evening. I have a slide that I'd like us to look at. But I thought we would just take a moment to just be quiet, and then I'll put the slide up and we can kind of go through them. So let's just take a moment. What I read here. This is the poem by Ian. It's Ian McCrory. We must start from where we are, not from where we want to be. For where we want to be is to be content with where we are. Maybe in hell. But if we are patient and allow hell to just be hellish, then this balance of mind, this quiet contentment, changes hell into heaven. The 1/16th of an inch difference between heaven and hell is equanimity. So may these precepts, refuges and precepts, bring equanimity to us. Whenever we may feel darkness or doubt or struggle or feel like we're falling. Let's see if I can share my screen. There it is. All right. So can you see that? Do you need a... Do I need to scoot this over some? Or can you see the full thing? All right, great. So what I thought we would do is I will say them and I will leave some time. You can say them along with me. We'll stay on mute and we can say them along with me if you know them. Many of you do. And for those of you who don't, I'll leave some pauses and say it in a slower way so you can say it on your own. Some breaks in there. We'll do the refuges together and then we'll do the precepts next. All right. This first part, Namo Tassa, is what it's called. For those of you that don't know, is just basically the homage to the Buddha for going through what he went through to awaken and then share that knowledge with us. That's pretty much what it is. So you can put your hands together if you want to. You don't have to. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Tonight I am. I just feel that way. And so it's up to you whether you want to or not. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiampi Bhutam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. To the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Sangha, I go for refuge. These precepts, we will say the precept, and then we will say the English right after it. The one thing I want to explain for those of you that aren't used to Pali, the first word with the comma by it, that portion, the first part, that's the precept itself. The next phrasing of the three words, Brahmani, Sikapadam, Samadhiyami, that is basically saying I undertake the training to refrain from. And so it is a killing, I undertake the training to refrain from. And then there's a taking and undertake the training to refrain from. So I will pause after that first phrasing. And then you'll see as we go through the five precepts that the Brahmati, Sikapadam, and Samadhiyami will do those pretty much together. Once you say it a couple of times, then you can kind of remember how to say it. All right? Panatipata Brahmati, Sikapadam, Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. Adinadana Viramani Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Kamesu Vachacharara Viramani Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Musawada Viramani Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. Sira Mirya Majapamatatana Viramani Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So, Tim, who's going to do the next part? You want to start the next part? Well, me, I am ready to go. All right. So we wanted to take some time to talk a little bit about Donna and volunteering with Sims. We don't usually we talk about Donna all the time on retreat. But it's hard to talk about Donna and volunteering in like everyday sanghas, because we see each other all the time. It's not the specialness of retreat. But we need to talk about it. Especially now, we need to talk about it. SEMS doesn't really do an annual appeal, a year-in appeal that many of you may have gotten from Spirit Rock and IMS and all these other organizations. We don't really do that. But there's something internally special about this tradition and how this tradition operates. One is this idea of Donna, or in, it's actually the word of generosity, and understanding how important generosity is. I don't know how many of you know this, but the actual generosity towards Sims has dropped substantially. It is a noticeable drop. And I think it's because we're not really in person and we are online. And so as soon as we get offline, we just sort of are at home. And then that's just it. And there was something about the coming together that helped us see that there's an organization here that needs to be supported. But I've been afraid. I've had this kind of worry for some time now, because we took on this added responsibility of getting our own space. We both need our own space, and it cost more to have our own space. And we spent a good 5 years living in a space where we didn't have to pay rent. And we kind of gotten into a way of thinking that maybe Sims is just going to be here. But it's just not true. We do have reserve funds. But if we are not able to maintain our upkeep, I do think that there's going to be some things that are going to go by the wayside in this sangha that many of us may not, or many of you may not be prepared for seeing. So I just want to talk just a couple of minutes about what Donna is to me. Because from my perspective, the greatest thing that the Buddha ever did was to tie Donna to the existence of his sangha. His monastics could not exist without a community taking care of them. And the community taking care of the monastics was a way for the monastics to also bring the Dhamma to them. And so that tying those two things together, not charging a fee and then you come and you pay, but tying the act of giving as a thing towards the continuation of the Sangha, it's just like brilliant to me. So if you think about it, we share the same air with trees. This is the way I have contemplated this. We share the same air with plants, animals. All of us share the same air. So all the plants give us the oxygen we need, and we give out the carbon they need. So between us giving, we have to exist for them to exist, and they have to exist for us to exist. And there is a natural order in that, a natural flowing of that. It doesn't matter if it's a redwood tree or if it's a Charlie Brown tree. It doesn't really matter. We don't really think, oh, I need to have a special kind of tree. And they don't really think, oh, I need to have a certain kind of, I want to have only the wealthy people sending me the carbon. I don't want any carbon from the poor people. I don't think the trees in the poor neighborhoods care how much money anybody's got. I think they just care about whether you continue to breathe. And likewise, we don't care about what kind of tree exists around us. We just want them to send us the oxygen. And together, we kind of make it work. It's why clearing away all these forests are going to ultimately cause us so much trouble, because we need it. It's the same way with Sims. We need everyone to contribute at whatever level you contribute is of your own accord. It's not just the contributing to the teachers. It's just contributing. Because the more you practice generosity in a world that is jumping up and down screaming scarcity, the less you get entangled in the delusion of the world. And the more you get entangled, get in infused with the gift of Dhamma and the Sangha. But besides Dana as money, because we definitely need money to pay the rent, we also need to make sure there's enough people to actually continue the Sangha. I mean, online is one thing, it's great. But at some point, we have to get back together again. But in order for us to get back together again, we have to go back to doing the volunteering that we used to do and things like that. And it takes a lot to run an organization as large as Sims. I don't know how many of you know, but we're one of the largest organizations, sanghas, in the country. And it takes a lot to run that. But no one person can do that. There's a few people on this call that are holding it down for the rest of us. I know this. But that's part of the weightedness that's happening. If we spread out the responsibility, we can create a Sangha that energy is lighter and it moves quicker. So what that means is there are all kinds of jobs, all kinds of things that we need people to help us with. And you don't have to live in Seattle to offer some help, because we have moved into a much more digital world. You can do some things that are just online, but you're still part of Sims and you're still helping. But I do believe that when Rodney used to say, if we didn't actually come together and do the work to make something happen, he would let it go. He just wouldn't do it. I understand now, being a teacher, what he was pointing to. I used to hate it when he said that. But now I understand that he knew that we could not continue to promise to offer services to the Sangha if the Sangha itself wasn't willing to help make that happen. And so Tim and I'm finished with my piece. We were both wanting to just talk about the truth that even though we're mostly online, in a few months, we are going to be in a whole new space. And we are going to have to pay the added cost for the rent of that space to make sure that people come and keep this upkeep of the space and make sure that we have a way to connect to this much larger branch that we have of people that, some of the people that come to Sims regularly live as far away as Australia, and finding a way to make sure everybody feels interconnected and not only the people that happen to show up on a Monday night and do work. So I am grateful that we have this Sangha, and I'm grateful that we do it strictly by your own volunteering and your own decisions around Donna, and that there's no expectation for anything to be any different. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tori.
Welcome.
And speaking of the new place, I want to also thank all those who have supported us in that capital campaign and the fundraising. There was a tremendous amount of generosity that we blew past our goal. And, you know, on the board, you know, I was thinking of a much more modest goal, and we just went right past that. So I thank you for your generosity around that. You know, I was reflecting on, I often reflect on Donna, that the Buddha, when someone wanted to start to practice, he would come up with, okay, three main areas to practice. So one is around sila, around ethics, the precepts. Another one was around generosity, around dana. And the third area was around that cultivation of mindfulness, of meditation. And, you know, why have those three elements? You know, the sense of, so often we come into our practice very much self-centered, kind of isolated, you know, we're defended. And when we first come into that, okay, this concept, okay, my actions do matter, how I treat other people, it starts to make me shift from that self-centered focus to caring for the community. And same thing with generosity. There's an expression of care, of offering our time, our energy, and our means, if that's applicable, to help support others and to support, you know, causes. And then our practice, what we spend so much of our time in, is cultivating that quality of wisdom. And these three elements really work well together. They help us really live our practice. If we just meditated and did nothing else, it would be a very limited practice. But when we engage with our generosity, engage with our volunteering, we engage with our actions, really making them based in non-harm, then we're really starting to live the practice. There's some point when I was in my own practice that there was a switch that happened, that I would go to a sitting and I could not think about Donna. I could not, you know, it's like I would automatically notice, okay, where's the Donna basket? How can I support the organization? How can I support the teacher? And where, you know, how can I support that? It just became something ingrained in me. And before that, it was kind of like, oh, I'm just, you know, kind of maybe trying to get by without offering anything, or other people will do it and it's okay. But something shifted at some point. And the same thing with volunteering. There was this point where I stopped being this kind of passive recipient to actually wanting to engage, to help, to support. I think in that moment, I became really a member of Sims instead of just this kind of passive consumer of the Dharma. I really cared for, you know, what can I do? Can I put a chair away? For those who remember Bodell Hall and all the careful stacking of chairs, you know, all the flurry of activity of putting cushions away. I love to do that, to just share in this simple activity, you know, stepping into bigger volunteering roles and caring, you know, over time, how can I help a non-residential retreat work well? And just that sense of volunteerism is so essential. It's what Sims has been based on from day one, back when Rodney started an invitation of a group of Seattleites. It was based in Donna, that okay, everyone's welcome to come regardless of ability to pay, and it's all volunteer. And we've continued that to this day, some 25 years, some 30 years later, that we are all an all-volunteer organization. You know, that everything that gets done, you know, this call was set up by a series of volunteers. you know, the website that you went to, you know, find the link, that was also created by volunteers. You know, Dara, who's helping with the AV and helping the tech support, is a volunteer. It's like everything is touched by the spirit of volunteerism. And Donna, you know, the Donna helps support the teacher's livelihood, our ability to continue to teach, and helps the organization to have the ability to continue to offer these things. And as Tuari said, that if things don't have enough support for, we can't keep offering them. It's just the hard fact of it. Like one of the main issues with the in-person meetings is having enough volunteers to help support the hybrid. You know, it takes time. It takes one individual has been spending so much of our time doing that. It's not fair to have one person have to do that. We're very grateful, of course, to Cheryl and all she's done. And we need other people to be able to step up. And if we can't step up, then we just simply won't offer it. And that's the way it is. So, you know, consider that. You know, it's often a kind of a step of courage to come forth and volunteer and say, okay, I'm gonna help out. But every time that I've done it, I've been very well rewarded. You know, rewarded by the engagement, the sense of support, and just the delight of being able to be part of the community. And in terms of Donna itself, you know, there's something about the online world that there's a little bit of a disconnect around it. You know, as Tuari was saying, it's just, you know, like an evening like tonight, you know, we might only get a few people relatively offering Donna to us. Well, in the past, when we had an in-person meeting, you know, the Donna basket would be overflowing. And so it's not to say that, you know, you should give any amount. It's really seriously a heartfelt amount. You know, give what is appropriate for your own means, your own financial situation. But it's important to have some engagement, because if you're not offering Donna to the organization and to the teachers, there's a little bit of a disconnect in your practice. I know it's awkward online, you know, if you're not used to the PayPal and Venmo and Zelle and all that stuff, it's a little overwhelming. And sometimes you feel, I'm only going to offer a little bit. It's not worth offering. If you have 100 people, you know, having the same thoughts, then we have what we have. So, you know, try to have an alive relationship to Donna. And it's not, again, the amount doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's a little bit or a lot. It's really something that reflect as you give Donna, don't do it as an obligation, but really do it from a place of heartfulness. You know, really, you know, contemplate it before you offer Donna and while you're offering it. And then afterwards, reflect how you're supporting everyone's practice, how you're supporting the teaching to continue as it has for these 2,600 years and may continue on for the next 2,600. So again, I thank you for your generosity and your support, both in Donna and also as volunteers. Do you want to do the ox herding first, or do you want me to worry?
I can talk a little bit about the ox herding tales. I don't know how many of you know about the ox herding tales, but that's what we're going to work with this year. And I am so thrilled that we are going to do it. Mostly because we have been talking about content of the Donna, of the Dhamma, for several years now. We did the Paramis, we did the Four Noble Truths, we did the dependent origination, and we did a time where we did the hindrances and the seven factors. And we've done the Dhamma in everyday life. So we've talked a lot about the subject matter of Dhamma. But what the ox herding tales point to is how it is that we apply the Dhamma in any given situation. How the struggle, our basic struggle between knowing something in Dhamma and applying it in the actual moment in time. How do we go about doing that and beginning to recognize that struggle as part of practice and not see it as, oh man, I don't get it. oh man, I can't seem to get this Dhamma. I keep messing up. Something's not going right. I'm not doing it right. Instead of getting caught up in all that, the ox herding tales are a way of helping us see that that arc, that way of relating to any given moment between dukkha and Dhamma is the nature of practice. It is what we all go through, and it comes out of a teacher who wanted his students to understand how Dhamma unfolds. And so you could look at it as a beginning practitioner. Like, there are some people that are going to take Tim's beginning class coming up this week, and they are beginning practitioners, and they are going to find their way into understanding Dhamma through the ox herding tales. But at the same time, there are people who have 20 years of practice. I've been practicing 20 years. But in a moment of struggle, of dukkha, you also need to find your way into Dhamma. Find your way into the liberation that comes from Dhamma, or the transformation that comes from Dhamma. And the ox herding tales are just a way to help you see where you are in that transformative moment in time. So I love them. I look forward to them. I'm trying to create that little board that I used to do. And I'm really glad that we're doing them, because I love them. So Tim, what do you want to share about them?
Yeah, thank you, Tori. Yeah, the ox herding pictures, they come from the Zen tradition. And you know, for myself, I'm not very dogmatic about where teachings come from. If they seem to be helpful, they seem to be useful, it doesn't matter if it comes from the Christian tradition or the Buddhist or Zen or Tibetan or, you know, any other tradition. If it speaks to the Dharma, it's helpful. And I think the Zen way of approaching it has a level of clarity, a level of power that I think is so rich and wonderful to explore. And as I like how Tori was speaking of these, as you know, of seeing how do we engage in the Dharma even when there are sets of difficulty. Because it's interesting, you look at them, it's a set of 10 images with often a little verse with them, that each month we'll explore one of them at a time. We'll do an overview at the beginning and review at the end. But each one of those, it's like almost a sequential, the way it's laid out, it's a sequential movement through these 10 phases, kind of from complete ignorance to complete awakening, you know, a complete embodiment of that. And so in some ways we can get caught in that, oh, I have to be in this certain stage. Am I at, you know, stage 5 or am I at stage 6, you know? But I think it's the way she was speaking of it, I think it's much more helpful to realize that each one of those, when we're in the midst of a difficulty, it's like, okay, then we're searching for where the ox is. It seems completely out of sight. And that's okay. It doesn't matter if we've been practicing for decades or just for a few days. It's like that's, we can come back to that. In the same way, in the midst of struggle or midst of beauty, whatever our life is presenting, there's the potential for those pictures to be a guide of how to release in deeper and deeper ways into our practice. And each one of the images have a certain teaching around them, a certain way of relating. And I think it's helpful to notice, okay, here I am, I'm really searching for that ox, or I'm riding the ox home, or I've forgotten the ox, to kind of recognize those phases, to recognize, okay, that's what's arisen. And to realize, you know, it's not that's once you got to that phase, you never have it never regress or never go back to the earlier phase. It's just the natural part of integration of our Dharma in our lives. So I'm looking forward to this exploration. It's always exciting to see what arises, you know, as I hold my mind around it. And as you bring your own engagement around it, the questions that you bring forth and you're sharing, all of these help really enrich this process of exploration. So I look forward to this year with Tori. It's so helpful for us to have this common thread that really unifies, you know, Monday nights and Sunday mornings and Thursday nights, and just this beautiful unifying factor. So thank you.
Yeah, that's good that you brought that up, Tim. Wait, am I? Yeah, it's good that you brought that up, Tim, that we do the same thread on Sunday mornings. We use the same thread on Thursday nights so that there's a level of continuity in whatever sit you go to. So if you can't go to a Monday but you want to do Sunday morning, we're in the same thread and you won't really miss any of the tales, any of the pictures. I love it. Good. Hey, Tim, I think we finished early enough to take some comments to see if people want to share. And we were hoping that we would go quick enough so that we could hear from you. And if you had questions or if you had comments you wanted to make, say hi, whatever. We're pretty much open. Iris, thank you for getting us started.
Thanks both to you, Tuari, and Tim, so much for this evening. And it's lovely to see you again, Tuari. It's been a little while.
It's been a while.
and I want to, I can't think of the word, unfortunately, affirm what both you and Tim spoke about with regards to volunteering. I've been coming to SIM for 10 or 11 years. And when I started back at Lodell Hall, very soon I started volunteering on Tuesday nights. And then just did one volunteer job after another. And, you know, even though I was still with my sort of neurotic mind frame of, oh, I don't belong and do people like me and blah, 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 I very quickly felt part of this beautiful community. So, and I think I did like every job, you know, with the residential retreats and, you know, so much fun. And you just become a part of the community and it really makes a difference. So I highly encourage. And it was easier when we were all in person, maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, life isn't easy, right? So, you know, so go online and look up, you know, to the volunteer page. And communicate to the volunteer, whoever is taking those emails now, and, you know, find something that you can do, and it will be well worth your while. Thank you.
It will be. Thank you so much. Let's see, who's next? Sheila.
Oh, hi, Tuari. Hi. I just wanted to say a big thank you to both you and Tim. And I wanted to say, being a non-Seattle person, how much I appreciate this sangha and love it.
That's right, from Canada.
From Canada. And, you know, in terms of volunteering, I wanted to sort of say I'd love to volunteer. I'm not terribly techy, you know, but so how would we find out, you know, as a person who's not there, you know, what things that we might be able to do? I would be interested in that.
Oh, yes. I think there's a post. I think somebody put in the chat the link that you go to for volunteering. And we do have they're not too techy. Little things that you can do that could help that tremendously.
Okay, well, that would be great. And just one more thought was, I couldn't catch the name of the series you're doing next year. Ox, what it is? Ox, what is the name? Spell it for me.
It's called Ox, O-X, and then they're herding, H-E-R-D-I-N-G.
Okay.
They're Ox Herding Tales. And it's the stories or the pictures that a teacher used to help his students understand where they were on the practice.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, that Dara said that Asha's Zoom support role is easy. It doesn't require a lot of techie. Since you come, you can just come on and do that. That's great.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Jacqueline? Oh, you got to unmute yourself, though.
I wanted to say just a couple of words about generosity. It feels really good when you're inspired by a talk to put money in the Donna basket or to donate money, but the rent has to be paid every month.
That's right. It does.
I would encourage people, a painless way to do it is just to automate your donations, to figure out a way to have whatever heartfelt amount is comfortable for you and your budget to just automatically give that to Sims every month. Because, you know, the rent has to be paid every month. The teachers have to eat.
Yes.
And I encourage people to do that, as well as giving, as when your heart moves you to, it's good to do it on a regular basis.
It is. Thank you so much. Yeah, it is. You know, and I didn't ask Tim, though I have a feeling his heart is like mine. If you only had a little bit to give, give to Sims first and give to the teachers second. Because oftentimes we will think about the teachers, but we forget that Sims, Tim and I we have to have a place to come teach. You could all try to fit in my little studio, but it's not going to work, I'm sure. So it's one of those things where if you gave to Sims, Sims gives to us. And it's good to give to teachers. I don't want to dismiss that, but I don't want you to get stuck in a dilemma and not give it all, because it's the giving that's going to open your heart. Let's see, Jean.
Thank you. I love the Sangha.
That's right, you do.
And I wanted to share a little bit of a story. Many years ago, a friend of mine asked me, Jean, do you know anything about African-American New Year's traditions? And my answer was no. And he began to talk about having a pot of food on the stove, cooking, hoping that there would be plenty of food all year. You would clean your house so that you would be welcoming visitors. But the one that was really important and stuck in my mind was, it was important who knocked on your door. Who did you open your door to, the first person in the year? And I felt like, I answered the knock on the door. It came via the computer, and here are 100 lovely, beautiful people in front of me. I've opened my door. There you are. And I'm really glad for that. It's exciting. And
you hit mute, Jean.
I'm sorry. I cut myself off. Maybe I should have. I have a wish for all of us that in the coming year, we find the 1/16th of an inch that separates heaven from hell, and that's in equanimity.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, one more thing, Gene, you're going to have some greens and some black-eyed peas. If you want to have money.
That's in my pot.
That's right. If you want to have money and you want to have good luck, you're going to have some greens and black-eyed peas. Barbara, how you doing?
Hi. I just wanted to reiterate Iris and Jacqueline and thank both you and Tim for bringing up Donna. I think the online world, as wonderful as it is, it can really separate us from the fact that there are people and a physical place that we need to be. And I can remember going to Bloedel Hall and just like going, oh, you know, and then getting into a habit of like going to the cash machine this week and I'm going to stick my Donna in my pocket and it's going to be there when I go. And we just have to think about it differently. That's all. Mm-hmm. So thank you for the reminder.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Wow. Tim, I see that. It's Barbara. Tim? Do you want to give us some closing comments? And is there anyone else that wants to say anything? I don't want to prevent anyone from sharing if they wanted to. I think we're good.
Clary, were we going to do announcements?
Yeah, that's what Tim's about to do.
I think Cubba is actually prepared to do the announcements.
So oh, I see. I see.
Cubba is okay. Our new board president. So,
Tim, do you have any closing comments since I said everything with the, I did all the questions and comments?
Well, you said just what I would have said. You did it. It was,
that all was right, wonderful. Good.
Yeah, thank you. It was, you know, and none of those people were paid to make those announcements.
No.
It was all very heartfelt and spontaneous. So thank you all for, you're putting your voice in around, you know, Donna around volunteering. And it, you can see it is, Sims is not any one person. It's really the whole of us. And this is a great time to remind us of that we come together, we practice, and it's a year process, you know, year to year, you know, some people come, some people go, but it's, there's so many that stay that, you know, may we continue to deepen and grow as a community. So thank you all, and thank you, Tori.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Appreciate you. So we'll just sit a moment to bring some quiet back, and then we'll let everybody go. How about if we read the poem one more time? We must start where we are. Not from where we want to be, for where we want to be is to be content with where we are. We may be in hell, but if we are patient and allow hell to just be hellish, then this balance of mind, this quiet contentment, changes hell to heaven. The 1/16th of an inch difference between heaven and hell is equanimity. All right.